the 21st. Have the anxieties of this anxious time shaken me a little at last? I have been writing for the last few days in a tone of levity which heaven knows is far enough from my heart, and which it has rather shocked me to discover on looking back at the entries in my journal. Perhaps I may have caught the feverish excitement of Laura's spirits for the last week. If so, the fit has already passed away from me and has left me in a very strange state of mind. A persistent idea has been forcing itself on my attention ever since last night that something will yet happen to prevent the marriage. What has produced this singular fancy? Is it the indirect result of my apprehensions for Laura's future? Or has it been unconsciously suggested to me by the increasing restlessness and irritability which I have certainly observed in Sir Percival's manner as the wedding day draws nearer and nearer? Impossible to say. I know that I have the idea, surely the wildest idea under the circumstances, that ever entered a woman's head. But try as I may, I cannot trace it back to its source. This last day has been all confusion and wretchedness. How can I write about it? And yet I must write. Anything is better than brooding over my own gloomy thoughts. Kind Mrs. Vesey, whom we have all too much overlooked and forgotten of late, innocently caused us a sad morning to begin with. She has been, for months past, secretly making a warm Shetland shawl for her dear pupil. A most beautiful and surprising piece of work to be done by a woman at her age and with her habits. The gift was presented this morning, and poor, warm-hearted Laura completely broke down when the shawl was put proudly on her shoulders by the loving old friend and guardian of her motherless childhood. I was hardly allowed time to quiet them both, or even to dry my own eyes, when I was sent for by Mr. Fairley, to be favoured with a long recital of his arrangements for the preservation of his own tranquillity on the wedding day. Dear Laura was to receive his present, a shabby ring with her affectionate uncle's hair for an ornament instead of a precious stone, and with a heartless French inscription inside about congenial sentiments and eternal friendship. Dear Laura was to receive this tender tribute from my hands immediately, so that she might have plenty of time to recover from the agitation produced by the gift before she appeared in Mr. Fairley's presence. Dear Laura was to pay him a little visit that evening, and to be kind enough not to make a scene. Dear Laura was to pay him another little visit in her wedding dress the next morning, and to be kind enough again not to make a scene. Dear Laura was to look in once more, for the third time, before going away, but without harrowing his feelings by saying when she was going away, and without tears, in the name of pity, in the name of everything. Dear Marian, that is most affectionate and most domestic and most delightfully and charmingly self-composed, without tears. I was so exasperated by this miserable, selfish trifling at such a time that I should certainly have shocked Mr. Fairley by some of the hardest and rudest truths he has ever heard in his life if the arrival of Mr. Arnold from Polesdene had not called me away to new duties downstairs. The rest of the day is indescribable. I believe no one in the house really knew how it passed. The confusion of small events, all huddled together, one on the other, bewildered everybody. There were dresses sent home that had been forgotten. There were trunks to be packed and unpacked and packed again. There were presents from friends far and near, friends high and low. We were all needlessly hurried, all nervously expectant of the morrow. Sir Percival especially was too restless now to remain 5 minutes together in the same place. That short, sharp cough of his troubled him more than ever. He was in and out of doors all day long, and he seemed to grow so inquisitive on a sudden that he questioned the very strangers who came on small errands to the house. Add to all this the one perpetual thought in Laura's mind and mine, that we were to part the next day, and the haunting dread, unexpressed by either of us, and yet ever present to both, that this deplorable marriage might prove to be the one fatal error of her life and the one hopeless sorrow of mine. For the first time in all the years of our close and happy intercourse, we almost avoided looking each other in the face, and we refrained by common consent from speaking together in private through the whole evening. I can dwell on it no longer. Whatever future sorrows may be in store for me, I shall always look back on this 21st of December as the most comfortless and most miserable day of my life. I am writing these lines in the solitude of my own room, long after midnight. Having just come back from a stolen look at Laura in her pretty little white bed, the bed she has occupied since the days of her girlhood. There she lay, unconscious that I was looking at her. Quiet, more quiet than I had dared to hope, but not sleeping. The glimmer of the nightlight showed me that her eyes were only partially closed. The traces of tears glistened between her eyelids. My little keepsake, only a brooch, lay on the table at her bedside with her prayer book and the miniature portrait of her father, which she takes with her wherever she goes. I waited a moment, looking at her from behind her pillow as she lay beneath me, with one arm and hand resting on the white coverlid, so still, so quietly breathing, that the frill on her nightdress never moved. I waited, looking at her, as I have seen her thousands of times, as I shall never see her again. And then stole back to my room. My own love, with all your wealth and all your beauty, how friendless you are. The one man who would give his heart's life to serve you is far away, tossing the stormy night on the awful sea. Who else is left to you? No father, no brother, no living creature but the helpless, useless woman who writes these sad lines and watches by you for the morning in sorrow that she cannot compose, in doubt that she cannot conquer. Oh, what a trust is to be placed in that man's hands tomorrow, if ever he forgets it, if ever he injures a hair of her head. The 22nd of December. 7 o'clock. A wild, unsettled morning. She has just risen, better and calmer now that the time has come than she was yesterday. 10 o'clock. She is dressed. We have kissed each other. We have promised each other not to lose courage. I am away for a moment in my own room. In the whirl and confusion of my thoughts, I can detect that strange fancy of some hindrance happening to stop the marriage still hanging about my mind. Is it hanging about his mind, too? I see him from the window, moving hither and thither, uneasily among the carriages at the door. How can I write such folly? The marriage is a certainty. In less than half an hour, we start for the church. 11 o'clock. It is all over. They are married. 3 o'clock. They are gone. I am blind with crying. I can write no more. 11th, 1850. June 11th, 1850. 6 months to look back on. 6 long, lonely months since Laura and I last saw each other. How many days have I still to wait? Only one. Tomorrow, the 12th, the travellers return to England. I can hardly realize my own happiness. I can hardly believe that the next 24 hours will complete the last day of separation between Laura and me. She and her husband have been in Italy all the winter, and afterwards in the Tyrol. They come back, accompanied by Count Fosco and his wife, who propose to settle somewhere in the neighbourhood of London, and who have engaged to stay at Blackwater Park for the summer months before deciding on a place of residence. So long as Laura returns, no matter who returns with her. Sir Percival may fill the house from floor to ceiling if he likes, on condition that his wife and I inhabit it together. Meanwhile, here I am, established at Blackwater Park, the ancient and interesting seat as the county history obligingly informs me, of Sir Percival Glyde, Bart, and the future abiding place, as I may now venture to add on my own account, of plain Marian Holcombe, spinster, now settled in a snug little sitting-room, with a cup of tea by her side, and all her earthly possessions ranged round her in three boxes and a bag. I left Limeridge yesterday, having received Laura's delightful letter from Paris the day before. I had been previously uncertain whether I was to meet them in London or in Hampshire, but this last letter informed me that Sir Percival proposed to land at Southampton and to travel straight on to his country house. He has spent so much money abroad that he has none left to defray the expenses of living in London for the remainder of the season, and he is economically resolved to pass the summer and autumn quietly at Blackwater. Laura has had more than enough of excitement and change of scene, and is pleased at the prospect of country tranquillity and retirement which her husband's prudence provides for her. As for me, I am ready to be happy anywhere in her society. We are all, therefore, well contented in our various ways to begin with. Last night I slept in London, and was delayed there so long, today, by various calls and commissions, that I did not reach Blackwater this evening until after dusk. Judging by my vague impressions of the place thus far, it is the exact opposite of Limeridge. The house is situated on a dead flat, and seems to be shut in, almost suffocated to my North Country notions, by trees. I have seen nobody but the manservant who opened the door to me and the housekeeper, a very civil person who showed me the way to my own room and got me my tea. I have a nice little boudoir and bedroom at the end of a long passage on the first floor. The servants and some of the spare rooms are on the second floor, and all the living rooms are on the ground floor. I have not seen one of them yet, and I know nothing about the house except that one wing of it is said to be 500 years old, that it had a moat round it once, and that it gets its name of Black Water from a lake in the park. 11 o'clock has just struck, in a ghostly and solemn manner from a turret over the centre of the house, which I saw when I came in. A large dog has been woke, apparently by the sound of the bell, and is howling and yawning drearily somewhere round a corner. I hear echoing footsteps in the passages below, and the iron thumping of bolts and bars at the house door. The servants are evidently going to bed. Shall I follow their example? No, I am not half sleepy enough. Sleepy, did I say? I feel as if I should never close my eyes again. The bare anticipation of seeing that dear face and hearing that well-known voice tomorrow keeps me in a perpetual fever of excitement. If I only had the privileges of a man, I would order out Sir Percival's best horse instantly and tear away on a night gallop eastward to meet the rising sun. A long, hard, heavy, ceaseless gallop of hours and hours, like the famous highwayman's ride to York. Being, however, nothing but a woman condemned to patience, propriety, and petticoats for life, I must respect the housekeeper's opinions and try to compose myself in some feeble and feminine way. Reading is out of the question. I can't fix my attention on books. Let me try if I can write myself into sleepiness and fatigue. My journal has been very much neglected of late. What can I recall, standing as I now do on the threshold of a new life, of persons and events, of chances and changes during the past 6 months, the long, weary, empty interval since Laura's wedding day? Walter Hartwright is uppermost in my memory, and he passes first in the shadowy procession of my absent friends. I received a few lines from him after the landing of the expedition in Honduras, written more cheerfully and hopefully than he has written yet. A month or 6 weeks later, I saw an extract from an American newspaper describing the departure of the adventurers on their inland journey. They were last seen entering a wild primeval forest, each man with his rifle on his shoulder and his baggage at his back. Since that time, civilization has lost all trace of them. Not a line more have I received from Walter. Not a fragment of news from the expedition has appeared in any of the public journals. The same dense, disheartening obscurity hangs over the fate and fortunes of Anne Catherick and her companion, Mrs. Clements. Nothing whatever has been heard of either of them. Whether they are in the country or out of it, whether they are living or dead, no one knows. Even Sir Percival's solicitor has lost all hope, and has ordered the useless search after the fugitives to be finally given up. Our good old friend Mr. Gilmore has met with a sad check in his active professional career. Early in the spring, we were alarmed by hearing that he had been found insensible at his desk, and that the seizure was pronounced to be an apoplectic fit. He had been long complaining of fullness and oppression in the head, and his doctor had warned him of the consequences that would follow his persistency in continuing to work early and late, as if he were still a young man. The result now is that he has been positively ordered to keep out of his office for a year to come at least, and to seek repose of body and relief of mind by altogether changing his usual mode of life. The business is left, accordingly, to be carried on by his partner, and he is himself at this moment away in Germany, visiting some relations who are settled there in mercantile pursuits. Thus, another true friend and trustworthy adviser is lost to us. Lost, I earnestly hope and trust, for a time only. Poor Mrs. Vesey travelled with me as far as London. It was impossible to abandon her to solitude at Limeridge after Laura and I had both left the house, and we have arranged that she is to live with an unmarried younger sister of hers who keeps a school at Clapham. She is to come here this autumn to visit her pupil, I might almost say her adopted child. I saw the good old lady safe to her destination, and left her in the care of her relative, quietly happy at the prospect of seeing Laura again in a few months' time. As for Mr. Fairley, I believe I am guilty of no injustice if I describe him as being unutterably relieved by having the house clear of us women. The idea of his missing his niece is simply preposterous. He used to let months pass in the old times without attempting to see her. And in my case and Mrs. Vesey's, I take leave to consider his telling us both that he was half heartbroken at our departure to be equivalent to a confession that he was secretly rejoiced to get rid of us. His last caprice has led him to keep two photographers incessantly employed in producing sun pictures of all the treasures and curiosities in his possession. One complete copy of the collection of photographs is to be presented to the Mechanics Institution of Carlisle, mounted on the finest cardboard, with ostentatious red-letter inscriptions underneath, Madonna and Child by Raphael, in the possession of Frederick Fairley, Esquire. Copper coin of the period of Tiglath-Pileser, in the possession of Frederick Fairley, Esquire. Unique Rembrandt etching, known all over Europe as The Smudge, from a printer's blot in the corner which exists in no other copy, valued at 300 guineas, in the possession of Frederick Fairley, Esquire. Dozens of photographs of this sort, and all inscribed in this manner, were completed before I left Cumberland, and hundreds more remain to be done. With this new interest to occupy him, Mr. Fairley will be a happy man for months and months to come, and the two unfortunate photographers will share the social martyrdom which he has hitherto inflicted on his valet alone. So much for the persons and events which hold the foremost place in my memory. What next of the one person who holds the foremost place in my heart? Laura has been present to my thoughts all the while I have been writing these lines. What can I recall of her during the past 6 months before I close my journal for the night? I have only her letters to guide me, and on the most important of all the questions which our correspondents can discuss, every one of those letters leaves me in the dark. Does he treat her kindly? Is she happier now than she was when I parted with her on the wedding day? All my letters have contained these two inquiries, but more or less directly, now in one form and now in another, and all on that one point alone have remained without reply, or have been answered as if my questions merely related to the state of her health. She informs me over and over again that she is perfectly well, that travelling agrees with her, that she is getting through the winter for the first time in her life without catching cold. But not a word can I find anywhere which tells me plainly that she is reconciled to her marriage, and that she can now look back to the 22nd of December without any bitter feelings of repentance and regret. The name of her husband is only mentioned in her letters as she might mention the name of a friend who was travelling with them and who had undertaken to make all the arrangements for the journey. Sir Percival has settled that we leave on such a day. Sir Percival has decided that we travel by such a road. Sometimes she writes Percival only, but very seldom. In 9 cases out of 10, she gives him his title. I cannot find that his habits and opinions have changed and coloured hers in any single particular. The usual moral transformation which is insensibly wrought in a young, fresh, sensitive woman by her marriage seems never to have taken place in Laura. She writes of her own thoughts and impressions amid all the wonders she has seen, exactly as she might have written to someone else if I had been travelling with her instead of her husband. I see no betrayal anywhere of sympathy of any kind existing between them. Even when she wanders from the subject of her travels and occupies herself with the prospects that await her in England, her speculations are busied with her future as my sister, and persistently neglect to notice her future as Sir Percival's wife. In all this, there is no undertone of complaint to warn me that she is absolutely unhappy in her married life. The impression I have derived from our correspondence does not, thank God, lead me to any such distressing conclusion as that. I only see a sad torpor, an unchangeable indifference when I turn my mind from her in the old character of a sister and look at her through the medium of her letters in the new character of a wife. In other words, it is always Laura Fairley who has been writing to me for the last 6 months, and never Lady Glyde. The strange silence which she maintains on the subject of her husband's character and conduct she preserves with almost equal resolution in the few references which her later letters contain to the name of her husband's bosom friend, Count Fosco. For some unexplained reason, the Count and his wife appear to have changed their plans abruptly at the end of last autumn, and to have gone to Vienna instead of going to Rome, at which latter place Sir Percival had expected to find them when he left England. They only quitted Vienna in the spring, and travelled as far as the Tyrol to meet the bride and bridegroom on their homeward journey. Laura writes readily enough about the meeting with Madame Fosco, and assures me that she has found her aunt so much changed for the better, so much quieter and so much more sensible as a wife than she was as a single woman, that I shall hardly know her again when I see her here. But on the subject of Count Fosco, who interests me infinitely more than his wife, Laura is provokingly circumspect and silent. She only says that he puzzles her, and that she will not tell me what her impression of him is until I have seen him and formed my own opinion first. This, to my mind, looks ill for the Count. Laura has preserved far more perfectly than most people do in later life the child's subtle faculty of knowing a friend by instinct. And if I am right in assuming that her first impression of Count Fosco has not been favourable, I, for one, am in some danger of doubting and distrusting that illustrious foreigner before I have so much as set eyes on him. But patience, patience. This uncertainty, and many uncertainties more, cannot last much longer. Tomorrow will see all my doubts in a fair way of being cleared up sooner or later. 12 o'clock has struck, and I have just come back to close these pages after looking out at my open window. It is a still, sultry, moonless night. The stars are dull and few. The trees that shut out the view on all sides look dimly black and solid in the distance, like a great wall of rock. I hear the croaking of frogs faint and far off, and the echoes of the great clock hum in the airless calm long after the strokes have ceased. I wonder how Blackwater Park will look in the daytime. I don't altogether like it by night.